Good afternoon and welcome to the traveling Second Court of Appeals. We were supposed to have two oral arguments this afternoon, but one of our cases settled, so we have one oral argument. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Dana Womack, to my left, Justice Mike Wallach, and I'm Lee Gabriel. So if the clerk will call the case, we will proceed.
The court will now call Nicole Van Dorum Preston, their surviving spouse and personal representative, for the estate of Lieutenant J. Wesley Van Dorum, USN, deceased, et al., versus M1 Support Services, LP. May it please the court, Mr. Kevin Mahoney will argue for the appellant. Mr. Van Switty will argue for the appellee.
All right. Mr. Mahoney, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The trial court's grant of the plea to the jurisdiction in this case should be reversed for three reasons. First, this case, unlike American Canine, did not arise in a war zone. Second, the trial court violated maritime law when it permitted an allocation of fault to an immune third party, the United States Navy. And third, the extent of the Navy's control over appellee M1 and the Navy's alleged causal role in the crash giving rise to this case was highly disputed by admissible evidence, and that fact alone should have resulted in a denial of the plea. Your Honors, based on our research, no case in any jurisdiction and at any time involving an aviation government contractor has ever been dismissed on political question grounds. The trial court's dismissal of this case was without precedent. For decades, courts in Texas and throughout the United States have had the necessary expertise and the constitutional authority to decide these cases. American Canine did not change that fact. And at least for this federal maritime case, American Canine cannot change that fact. American Canine, all of the operative facts within that case arose in a wartime environment on a military base in Afghanistan. And the injury-causing event in that crash, or in that incident, the dog's escape from the kennel, was without dispute caused by the Army's wartime decision or its omission to improperly construct it. In contrast, this case involves airworthiness inspections that took place in the contiguous United States in Norfolk, Virginia. The mechanics conducting those inspections were civilian contractors employed by a private government contractor. Courts, when deciding whether or not a case is justiciable, applying Baker versus Carr, its progeny, and American Canine, they ask themselves, are there discoverable and manageable standards for applying the case before them? In concluding that the court lacked those standards, the trial judge ignored decades of precedent in factually identical cases to this one. And most importantly, it ignored the United States Supreme Court's decision in Boyle versus United Technologies. And in that case, which arose from facts very much like the case at Bar, a Navy sailor was killed in a helicopter crash during a training exercise off the coast of Virginia Beach. And the United States Supreme Court was very concerned with the capability of the civil justice system to cause second-guessing of military decision-making. And it addressed those concerns not by divesting the court of jurisdiction over the case or declining to hear it, but it created the Boyle government contractor defense. And what the government contractor defense says is it, in essence, makes the contract the applicable standard. If the defendant can show that it complied with the specifications of the contract, it's immune from liability. But importantly, it's not immune from suit. It's an affirmative defense that has to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence to a jury. The trial court's most obvious error in this case was its conclusion that the mere invocation of the federal government contractor defense rendered this case non-justiciable because it would place the Navy's intent behind the specifications at issue. But that is the central dispute in every government contractor defense case. Now, appellee seems to indicate in its brief that this might be permissible under American Canine, because American Canine was applying separation of powers principles under the Texas Constitution. And therefore, I disagree with this point, but arguably, a state could provide broader protections to the federal executive and to the United States military than a federal court or the federal constitution could. And I disagree with that again, but it's not the question before this court. And that is because this is a federal maritime case. And our clients have a near absolute right to vindicate their federal rights in a state court. And that's Haywood versus Drown, the United States Supreme Court decision. So the narrow question for this court, it does not need to address the applicability of the political question doctrine in a post-canine world for cases brought under Texas law. The question for this court is, could this case be heard in a federal court? And if it could be, then a state court can't shut its doors to us. And so this case is justiciable in a federal court, and it is for three reasons. First and foremost, as already described, this case presents nearly identical facts and issues as Boyle versus United Technologies. And Boyle provides a standard, the discoverable and manageable standard required by Baker, required by American Canine, that would permit a judge to adjudicate this case. And Boyle implicitly, if not explicitly, says that the courts would have the constitutional authority to do so. So that's reason one. Reason two, why this case is justiciable in a federal court, we've litigated cases against manufacturers arising from this very crash in the federal court, in the district court for the District of Connecticut. So if the court needed any more proof, and Canine and Baker instruct courts to look at the history of the adjudication of the dispute, if the court needed any more proof, it need look no further than the Van Dorn case in the District of Connecticut. And the third reason why this case is justiciable.
Was this issue raised in that case?
It was not raised, Your Honor. But I think because it's so clearly established, this was a Boyle case. Boyle was raised.
We can't assume that. I mean, we can't assume why it wasn't raised. We just know it wasn't raised.
Correct, Your Honor. It wasn't raised, but I think it's fair for the court to consider that fact, because the Baker analysis and the Canine analysis really require courts to look at other cases, and even if they don't raise the political question doctrine, and say, can a court adjudicate this case? Does it have the power, and does it have the standards and the tools, really, to apply to a given set of facts? And so it's a very fact-intensive exercise, and the parallel case in the federal action is proof that the court can consider this case.
But without the political question doctrine, as I recall, the trial judge in this case said, and without American Canine, he wouldn't have ruled the way he ruled.
Correct. I think that was the judge's erroneous reading of American Canine, because he expanded the political question doctrine so far outside the bounds of what the court wrote in the opinion. The court itself expressly warned that all cases involving government contractors or a military setting aren't necessarily barred. And it cited McMahon versus Presidential Airways, which is for proof of that fact, that a case involving an ordinary application of, you know, ordinary tort principles was justiciable. And I think that means a lot, because this case is an aviation government contractor case involving military aviation. And so was McMahon. And McMahon, even though it occurred in a war zone, was justiciable. But the third reason why this case is justiciable, would be justiciable in a federal court, even if the Navy's fault is front and center, and we highly dispute that it is because of a recent United States Supreme Court decision called Air and Liquid Systems versus DeVries. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court said that ex-Navy sailors alleged cognizable maritime personal injury claims for asbestos-related injuries. And that was even in cases where the Navy installed the asbestos, the disease-causing asbestos, in the ships at issue. So in that case, without dispute, the Navy is probably the primary cause of the sailors' injuries. But that didn't divest the court of jurisdiction over it. And that's why I think the location of this crash is really critical, because courts really pause in trying to export domestically created tort standards into a war zone. They say we don't have the necessary expertise to craft these standards, to tell a government contractor how it's supposed to operate convoys or conduct missile exercises or house bomb-sniffing dogs who are there to save lives. And not only that, they say we lack the expertise, but we're actually constitutionally prohibited from creating these standards. And that's because if we have the government contractor in a war zone second-guessing orders from the military because it's worried about being sued back home, we're now interfering with the executive's war-making function.
Well, American Canine really had nothing to do with war. This was a dog that was over there for that purpose, but there was nothing going on concerning that dog at the time that that particular injury or alleged injury occurred. The dog was, quote, playing.
That's correct.
There's a difference.
Well,
deploying convoys.
But I think the certified question to the Supreme Court in that case was basically the justiciability of battlefield torts, and that permeates through the entire court's reasoning. I think it started its opinion with a description of a military base and how it's named after a fallen soldier, and that context can't be removed from the trial court's decision, because in cases like this, in battlefields, in Afghanistan and in Iraq, these kind of tidy tort principles aren't readily transposed into battlefield environments where the Army sometimes necessarily needs to cut corners in the interests of combat effectiveness. And those concerns aren't present here.
Let me ask a question in terms of comparison of the Navy's fault versus the other parties and non-parties. You know, we used to have a rule that antecedent conduct occurring before the events in question didn't qualify as a basis for proximate cause. Now that's changed statutorily in Texas. How does that fit into the established law under the Death in the High Seas Act and general maritime law?
Effectively, the fault of another party besides the maritime defendant in a maritime case brought under the Death in the High Seas Act isn't really relevant to the jury question. The sole question for a jury, Justice Wallach, in considering the fault of a maritime defendant is whether or not its conduct was a substantial factor in leading to the plaintiff's injury. And that's because, unlike Texas law, maritime law embraces joint and several liability.
But in particular, I'm not talking about the Navy's conduct in general, but one of the things the parties have talked about in the briefs is the decision to keep flying these helicopters long past their useful life expectancy, so to speak. So that decision, which occurred presumably long before this particular event occurred, would be an antecedent conduct. Is that something which would even be properly subject to consideration on a causation basis?
I think only if a reasonable juror could conclude that that decision was the sole cause of the crash. And because the conduct is the sole cause of the crash, necessarily the maritime defendant's conduct was not a substantial factor in causing the plaintiff's injury. But obviously that's not the case here. There's ample evidence in the record indicating the fault of Appellee M1. They were the final entity to perform the critical phase C inspection on this helicopter about 118 flight hours before the crash. So
during those 118 flight hours before the crash, but after M1 looked at it, it was the Navy that was conducting pre-flight inspections, and the Navy that was doing the maintenance on this particular helicopter, wasn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor, but there's a very large difference between a rudimentary pre-flight inspection and a phase inspection. A phase inspection is very close to basically an overhaul of the aircraft. It is taken out of service and it's worked on. I think it was worked on, if I'm not incorrect, for about 1,800 hours. So in every military case, whenever there's a crash, there will have been a pre-flight inspection. But that doesn't render the case non-justiciable. It doesn't make that issue, these issues inextricable, such that trial court doesn't have the authority to adjudicate it. It's actually quite the opposite. The trial courts have an obligation to hear these cases, and only in the very narrow exceptions, and I think I counted five in the cases cited by both parties, I think I counted only five in which a court had actually dismissed a case involving a private government contractor on political question grounds, and all of those took place in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'd like to hold on to the maritime issue because I think it's important to note that the Navy's alleged fault, and again we can test it, there's actually no admissible evidence in the record indicating that the Navy had any relation to the causal chain that led to this crash, but...
They weren't the ones that came up with the phase cards?
They did, but we're not alleging that the phase cards were improperly written, and the dismissal in this case was dismissed prior to expert testimony. So there's no expert. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Whitty?
May it please the court. The district court correctly determined that the political question doctrine precluded the exercise of jurisdiction in this particular case. In fact, the court's decision was essentially dictated by the result of the American Canine case, because if the political question doctrine precludes an adjudication of a claim involving the training and housing of dogs, it certainly precludes adjudication of a claim where the Navy's procedure for maintaining and operating combat helicopters is questioned. The political question doctrine is at its most potent in cases involving the military because there is both a strong textual commitment to the legislative and executive branches in such cases, but also because the judiciary lacks the institutional competence to evaluate military decisions. And in the American Canine case, the court made clear that the separation of powers concerns that animate the political question doctrine are equally applicable in the state courts. Now, as applied to military contractors such as M1, the key questions relating to the application of the political question doctrine are, first, whether the military exercised plenary control over any aspect of the case that is significant to a determination of liability. In such cases, the decisions of the contractor are taken to be the decisions of the military itself. And second, whether the case would involve an evaluation of military decision making. Those two questions are disjunctive. In other words, if either is answered affirmatively, the political question doctrine is invoked. In this case, the district court determined that the undisputed evidence showed that the Navy maintained plenary control over the phase maintenance and other critical aspects of the case. And that is a fact finding that the district court was empowered to make because it was not intertwined in the merits of the case and must be sustained by this court if legally sufficient evidence supports it. Second, the district court determined that the claims and defenses in the case would necessarily involve an examination of Navy decisions. That question is a question of law, which we believe that the court correctly determined. With respect to the issue of plenary control, the evidence showed that M1 contracted with the Navy to provide phase maintenance for the Sea Dragon helicopters. And in this contractual regime, M1 was to comply with the Navy's documents and directives, correct any deficiencies noted by the Navy, and to comply with the Navy's staffing instructions. The Navy supplied a detailed technical manual with work cards, which are in the record, applicable to each of the functions that M1 was to perform. And these cards set forth the work zone, time guidelines, the skill set required, the tools, the technical directives, and steps for performing each of the inspection operations. The Navy supplied technical directives in a toughbook computer. It controlled the personnel that would be assigned to the tasks. It exercised quality control functions, and it supplied all of the components and tools used by the contractor in taking care of its assignment. So there was ample evidence before the court for it to determine that the Navy had plenary control. Now, when we discuss plenary control, it's important to know that the way it has been applied in many cases is that plenary control exists in situations where the military determines not only the what, that is, the task that is to be performed, but also the how the task is to be performed. And when it reaches a certain level of detail in the how, then a decision that plenary control exists can be made. In this case, I think we are far over the border into the plenary control sphere, even given the undisputed facts. If every fact about plenary control that is disputed by the plaintiffs is stricken from the court's decision making, there is still enough that is completely beyond dispute for that determination to be upheld. And of course, even in an area of disputed facts with regard to a jurisdictional question, the district court was empowered to make that determination so long as it was intertwined with the merits of the case, as it would not be in this particular situation. The district court also determined that the claims and defenses of the case would necessarily involve an examination of the Navy decisions. That is the jurisdictional issue in any case of this kind. In fact, that is exactly what the K-9 court said when it stated that the jurisdictional issue is whether the case involves reviewing military decisions. It's a very simple standard. In this case, various military decisions were brought into question by M1's defenses and its position, especially with regard to causation. Now, in this regard, it's important to note that it's not just plaintiff's theory of the case which is looked at when determining whether military decisions would be questioned, but it is also the way in which the case is going to be defended. So it's necessary to look at M1's position as well as the plaintiff's position in making that determination, as the court correctly did. Here, appellant's counsel conceded an oral argument that M1 could legitimately challenge Navy decision making, and stated that M1 could bring up an admiral, for example, as an expert witness to say that the Navy was incorrect in the way that it made its maintenance decisions. The decision to use Kapton electrical wiring and aluminum fuel tubing is a Navy decision that could be questioned. The use of plastic zip ties to keep the wiring and tubing from becoming separated. The decision to use the Sea Dragon helicopters far beyond their useful life when manufactured replacement parts were no longer available could be questioned. The decision to use Kapton wiring could be questioned. The decisions relating to the maintenance intervals and whether an interval of, in this situation, of 119 hours was too long could be questioned. And the decision regarding the minimum requirements themselves could well be questioned, especially in light of the fact that post-crash, the Navy changed many of those very determinations relating to the inspections of the components that were at issue in this case. Indeed, in the record for the plea to the jurisdiction, evidence was placed indicating that at least some of the appellants themselves had been critical of the Navy's use of the obsolete fleet, the inadequate maintenance procedures such as using cannibalized parts, and for prioritizing flight hours over safety. The Navy's role in this case was, as the district court determined, front and center, given the causation defenses that were raised.
How do you respond to their argument that there is not a single aviation case that's been dismissed as non-judiciable under the political question doctrine?
Well, counsel is correct in that there have not been a large number of these political question military doctrine cases. Mostly they have arisen only in the past few years when the military is transitioning to a much greater number, more tasks are being done by contractors and less by active service members than ever before. But counsel himself cites the Presidential Airways versus McMahon case, which was a military aviation case where the political question doctrine methodology that is applicable was applied to the case. Now, in that case, it was determined that there wasn't plenary control and the military decisions were not at issue in a case that was essentially one where the civilian contractor's pilot flew the contractor's own plane into a mountain, and in Afghanistan, as it happened to be. But there was nothing about that case at all that was unique to the military or that brought the military's decision making into question, unlike this case, where the military's questioning was front and center. But the point is that the McMahon case does provide an example of a military aviation case where the methodology for resolving a political question doctrine was used. It also seems that counsel is making an error when he emphasizes what he calls the routine nature of the case, that courts do aviation cases all the time or can adjudicate facts about maintenance of aircraft, and those occur in civilian litigation. And who could deny that? But it's important to note that that's not the end of the story. You also have to look at the particular factual context of each of the cases. If you look at the cases where the political doctrine, question doctrine, has been applied recently, you have cases such as the KBR burn pit case, which was, just from the standpoint of the plaintiffs at least, a simple toxic exposure case, or the Taylor versus KBR case, which was, from the standpoint of the plaintiff's theory, a simple tag-out, lockout procedure case where the defendant's negligence allegedly led to an electrocution. Civil cases like that throughout the United States all the time. But still, the political question doctrine was implicated because of the responsibility of the military personnel in that particular case and their decisions that they made with regard to electrifying the tank wrap. And perhaps most telling of all is the Carmichael case, where the political question doctrine was applied to a motor vehicle accident, perhaps the most single common type of civil litigation in American courts. Yet in that case, the political question doctrine was applied because of the plenary control that the military had over the convoy where the accident took place. And in that case, the court held that it was erroneous not to look at the overall contractual regime, but the plaintiff's theory was, well, this is an acceptable case that doesn't involve the political question doctrine because it's a simple matter of driver error that the other trucks in the convoy were able to negotiate the curb in question without an accident occurring. So there must have been some sliver of discretion left with the driver at that point, which enabled, he did not correctly exercise, and therefore the accident happened. But the Court of Appeals said, no, that's not a correct way of looking at it. You have to look at the overall contractual regime to determine whether plenary control existed or not. There have been other military aviation cases. Plaintiff also disregards the Tiffany case. That's a Fourth Circuit case from 1991. That was a case involving the scrambling of military aircraft to check into a plane that had flown into the U.S. territorial waters without having filed a flight plan. And in a low visibility situation, there was a mid-air collision. There was a subsequent suit where the Air Force's responsibility was brought into question. And in that case, the court did dismiss the action based on the political question doctrine. The court's the discussion about the military's potential allocation of responsibility should be addressed briefly as well. We do not agree with appellants that the military's responsibility could not be allocated in a maritime case. We think that footnote 10 to the McDermott case indicates that an immune party, such as the Navy's responsibility, could be determined in such a case. But really, that is not the ultimate determining question here. Whether or not the Navy is put on a percentage blank for the jury to determine, whether that ever happens or not, in the hypothetical trial, M1 is still going to be defending its case based upon it is not a substantial cause of the accident in question, and it's any causal role it had is not a proximate cause of the question of the accident in question. And it's going to be talking about the causal role played by the Navy, and it's going to be talking about the causal role played by the service members themselves, the decedents and the injured service member, and it's going to be talking about the responsibility of the settling parties. All of those, except maybe under the Navy, under their theory, they do go into the blank, but that's not really the determinative issue. The issue is whether or not their decision-making must be examined in the overall context of the case. And there was ample evidence indicating that that would be the case here, whether or not there was an express allocation of responsibility. The counsel also mentioned the air and liquid systems versus DeVries case. That case is not a political question doctrine case. That issue simply was never brought up in the case at all. It's a substantive products liability case, and it's only a sort of wish casting by the appellants, which even brings it into any sort of relevance into the case. Appellants erroneously assume that the government contractor case has some kind of particular bearing in this case that would make the political question doctrine inapplicable. That's not correct. The government contractor defense is a substantive defense. Its primary function is to protect the federal government from liability for performing certain discretionary functions.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Mahoney?
Thank you, Your Honors. I guess while we're on the subject, appellees are basically asking this court to adopt a limitless rule because, as I've already said, in a Boyle matters here because in every Boyle case, the military's decision-making is at issue because the parties are effectively arguing about the military's intent behind the contract. And in every case, that's disputed. And if this court agrees with counsel for appellee and says that renders the case non-justiciable, no future government contractor cases will be adjudicable in Texas, and that's a conclusion or a result that the Supreme Court in K-9 expressly warned against. Now, I want to talk about the standard of review in this court's review of the trial court's factual findings. I don't think counsel for appellee stated the standard right. This is a de novo review under plea to the jurisdiction jurisprudence. And the question for this court is whether there was a fact dispute over critical facts material or critical to the jurisdictional question. And there were ample factual disputes over the extent of the Navy's plenary control, alleged plenary control, over appellee's maintenance services. We had testimony from the Navy quality assurance representative on this contract, and he said that they weren't permitted to review M1's work. And in fact, that function, that quality review function under the contract, was expressly delegated to M1 personnel. And so for the critical inspection in this case, which was the CARD M12 inspection, that was an inspection that without dispute required M1 to determine the integrity of every single fuel line in the cabin of this helicopter. That was performed by an M1 wrench turner, they're called, an M1 worker, and the effectiveness, or that process was reviewed by an M1 collateral duty inspector. And all the Navy did in this process, according to his testimony and the documents, was make sure that CARD M12 was checked off. And so the Navy, at the very least, we present a factual dispute about whether the Navy actually exercised plenary control. And when there's a fact dispute that's material to the plea, it has to be denied. And American K-9 did not change that. And it said that it itself said that the review of the facts concerning plenary control is a de novo review.
Aren't there two prongs of the K-9 analysis, though? One being the plenary control and the other one being your claims and defenses. And aren't your claims, don't they implicate the Navy's decisions? Isn't that why you brought them in, designated them as a third-party defendant?
We did not designate.
I mean, they did. Okay.
They did. But as I said, it's front and center of every case. And I disagree with Appellee to answer that question. I disagree with his statement that I'm wish-casting when I describe the air and liquid systems versus DeVries case, because when this court is considering the political question, I think the quote is a historical imagination of these issues in other courts. And we have a decision from the United States Supreme Court in a maritime case issued in April, in which the Navy, without dispute, is a cause of the injury. And that doesn't divest the court of jurisdiction over it. And so I don't think that the Navy's designation, or the designation of the Navy as a third party, makes any difference. And it can't make a difference because Section 33.003 does not control the jury verdict form in this case. This jury verdict form is controlled by maritime law. And only in very discrete
circumstances. The jury verdict form, is that the magic answer, or is it whether your claim requires or implicates the Navy's decisions? Whether they're on the jury form or not, it still implicates the Navy's decisions, doesn't it?
Yes, well, the analysis in these cases, the discriminating analysis, is multifactored and fact-dependent. And one fact that American Canine looked at, relying on Harris, which was a Third Circuit case, was whether the defendant would be on the jury verdict form, and then whether the jury would have to allocate fault to it. And the Harris case, which Canine relied on, basically remanded that case to the trial court for a choice of law determination. And it said if the jury has to allocate fault, that will render the decision-making front and center trial, and the case might present a non-justiciable political question. Alternatively, if Pennsylvania law applied, I think, joint and several liability, the Navy wouldn't be on the jury verdict form. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your arguments and your briefs. This is we had a brief conversation about this case. It's very interesting. It's very unique. It's very novel to us. So we will give it a lot of study. Your case is submitted.